morning. I'm calling the Senate Education Committee to order at 8 a.m. Today is Friday, February 17th. This morning we have present Senator Coghill. Good morning, Senator Giesel. Good morning, and Senator Beckage. Good morning, and myself, Chair Hughes. Of course, you all know the cell phone thing. That's a good one first thing in the morning to remind you a bit about. Today we have a presentation regarding virtual education from two organizations that are leading the way nationally in this type of education. First, we'll hear from Virginia Gesler and Hallie Soggs, and if I mispronounced your names, please forgive me, and you can correct when you come on the record. And they are with the Florida Virtual School, which offers both part-time and full-time virtual education for students throughout the country. I understand that we even have a few Alaskan school districts who've purchased content from the Florida Virtual Schools. And then following Florida, we will hear from Mike Babuff with the New York State Distance Learning Consortium, which connects school districts throughout the state of New York to exchange virtual education courses with other districts. And so for Mr. Baba's presentation, we'll be actually using video conferencing software to give you a taste of what that's like. Because of this room's sound equipment, there may be a slight lag in the video, which might help us also relate to what some of the villages could experience. But we hope it doesn't impede our discussion. And so first, Virginia Gesler and Hallie Soggs with the Florida Virtual Schools. And then I understand Stephanie Steele and Henry Bokoff will be online for questions as well. So good morning, Virginia and Hallie. And I just want to mention before we give the floor to you that Senator Stevens has joined us. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Well, good morning there in Alaska. This is Virginia Gesler, and I want to say good morning to all. Holly is calling in on the 844 line as we speak. She had logged in through a different 800 number, so I apologize for that. We are with Florida Virtual School, and we were the first virtual school in the nation. And I'm just going to share a little bit of history about our organization, and then I'm going to hand it over to Holly, who will share with us some of the financial information. Holly is our executive director over government affairs and strategic solutions, so she's a wealth of information when it comes to that. Just a little history about us. The Florida Department of Education acted as a catalyst, initially encouraging a partnership between Orange County and Alachua County here in the state of Florida, and with a $200,000 grant, which was called Break the Mold, they piloted a first web school that offered five online courses. This partnership grew and became, in 1997, Florida High School, which is now FLVS, or Florida Virtual School, and initially started with only 7 staff members. Then, around 2003, we joined forces with other school districts to increase their capacity, give them their students options to be taking online courses with us inside the state. And let's see, then as of 2003, we became a recurring line item on Florida's legislative budget, and that's when we became fully funded through the Education Finance Program. Around about 2012, we continued to grow. Actually, growth exploded, and we offered over 120 courses to students here in the state of Florida. And then 2013, we graduated our first full-time group of 12th grade students, because inside the state of Florida, Florida Virtual School is its own school district as well. So that was our first graduating class back in 2013. And around about 2014, we reached a milestone of over 2 million semester courses completed by students inside the state of Florida. And then that's where we are today. We have, to this point, completed over 440,000 half-credit courses last year. In Florida, we offer students both a full-time option where they can graduate from Florida Virtual School with a diploma, or part-time enrollment where they take their normal brick-and-mortar courses, and if they either need to add on or do a credit recovery course, they can do that through Florida Virtual School as well. Not only have we grown in the state of Florida, but we also license our curriculum, which is very rigorous and really geared at making students college and career ready. We license those courses out throughout the United States. We're in every state in the United States, as well as internationally in Canada, China. There's a list of many different countries that use our content. To date, we have over 150 courses that we can offer, including core courses, elective, honors, AP, and credit recovery. At this point, we have over 1,200 full-time teachers and then a supplement of adjunct teachers. I believe our entire staff is over 2,000 at this point. Our courses are accredited and NCAA approved and aligned with the INACOL standards for quality online content. But ultimately, Florida Virtual School, we are a school. We are a nonprofit entity. Any of the revenue that is generated when other states and counties license our courses is then put back into developing more courses as well as improving the ones we already have. So that's just a little bit about Florida Virtual School, and I'm hoping Holly's been able to call in on the 800 line at this point.
Yes, Holly is here. Are you ready, Virginia, for her to begin?
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Well, thank you, and if you could stay online, we'll take questions after we hear from Holly. So welcome, Holly. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Chair Hughes, for inviting us today. And my name is Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, Sagas, S as in Sam, A-G-U-E-S as in Sam. And I am the Executive Director for Governmental Affairs and Strategic Solutions for Florida Virtual School. I know Virginia had one more slide around getting results, and so I can just hit that very quickly. If you could go back one slide, as you can see here, Florida Virtual School, since we are a public school in the state of Florida, we are held to the same accountability standards as every other public school, and this just gives you a summary of some of our end-of-course exams and our results, and you can see that Florida Virtual School exceeds the state average, I think, in just about every category, or matches the state average in just about every category for our students that take those courses. So we can go ahead and we can move on now to funding. All right, so Florida Virtual School has a long history of funding in Florida. We started out as a line item grant for the first few years, meaning that the legislature would award us a specific amount of money, and we would put a plan together to determine what courses we could develop and offer and how many students we would be able to serve. So in about 2003, the legislature included Florida Virtual School into the Florida Education Finance Program, the same program that all districts in Florida, all school districts in Florida belong to. However, our funding formula was set up a little bit differently, and it has since been expanded to all virtual education in Florida. So all virtual education in Florida is funded a little bit differently than how traditional schools and school districts are funded. So the thing that makes us most unique is that we are funded upon successful completion. So students must pass a semester course in order for Florida Virtual School or any virtual school in Florida to receive funding for that student. The way that the Florida Education Finance Program is set up in Florida is that it is a series of categoricals or allocations, and there are 22 of them. However, Florida Virtual School only receives 12. So, for example, there is really no need to fund a virtual program for transportation. So there are certain categories that just don't make sense for us to have because they are very school building based. So we receive a subset of the number of allocations that are available. So when you add those up, our funding level is lower. Now, Florida has a very somewhat unique categorical in that it is the class size categorical. Several years ago, there was a constitutional amendment that was passed that required students, teachers to only have so many students in certain grade levels and certain courses throughout their educational career. And Florida Virtual School used to receive those class size dollars. However, a few years back, those dollars were removed from our formula. And so when that happened, because Florida was investing a significant amount in that categorical, it dropped the dollars that were received for virtual education to a very low level. So the legislature said, okay, we recognize that since we took those dollars away, your funding level is too low. So we are going to set an amount and make it sort of like a hold harmless, so that you have kind of a floor as to what we will pay for virtual education. So the first year they did that, they set that floor at $4,800, and since that time, it's gone up to $5,230. And the way that it works, I'll try to explain it in kind of a macro level. The way that it works is if you add up all 12 of the categoricals that we receive, if it doesn't come to $5,230 per student, the state will kick in the amount of money to bring the funding up to that level. So each year, as funding increases across the board, this formula, because it's still in place for Florida Virtual School, the amount of money that goes into the program or into that specific categorical actually shrinks. So if you add up all 12 of the categoricals for Florida Virtual School, and let's say, for example, it comes to $5,000, this year the state would be kicking in $230 per student. Well, next year, after overall increases, may happen in Florida, let's say that when they add up the 12 categoricals, it comes to $5,100. Next year, they will only kick in $130. So our funding remains the same. We don't see an increase like the other districts do as of yet until this virtual education contribution is depleted. So I know that's really kind of complicated and a little crazy, but that is basically how it works. So if we could move to the next slide. You can see here how the funding for Florida Virtual School, since this change has happened, has remained pretty much stable. There are a few categoricals in our full-time school that we get outside of our funding formula, like Title I dollars and things like that. So you'll see a slight variation there. But you can see since 2013 that our funding has remained fairly stable. per student compared to the school districts in blue that are seeing a slight increase. And if we move to the following slide, you can see what our funding is per student. So you can see from 2013 on up, we've been somewhere between close to around 5,200 to 5,300. And that is all because of the way the formula works in Florida. Until we grow out of that formula, our funding will not go up in the same proportion as a traditional school district would. And that is the end of my presentation around funding.
All right. Do we members have questions? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Holly, how many Title I students do you serve?
Through the chair, I will be happy to address that question. We have a full-time school that serves about 7,000 students compared to about 200,000 students that we serve across the state in a part-time capacity. And of those 7,000 students, we are considered a Title I school, so about 40% of our students receive Title I, about 40% of our students are on free and reduced lunch.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Holly, I may have missed it, but have you explained the governance? You have a school board, elected board, appointed. How does that actually work? Who governs or who are you responsible to?
Through the chair, I'll be happy to answer Senator Stevens' question. We have a board that is appointed by our governor, and it's a 7-member board, and they meet on a monthly basis via phone call and then meet quarterly face-to-face.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Coghill.
Thank you very much, both of you, for explaining some of these things to Alaska. So it sounds like you also franchise some of your courses outside of the state. Is there a per-course charge, and how is that folded into your formula?
I'm happy to address that, Virginia, if you like.
Whoever addresses it, please state your name for the record for our secretary. Please, thank you.
Through the chair, this is Virginia Gessler. Yes, we do license out our courses to other states and districts, and there are several ways in which we do that. If a state or district needs teachers as well as courses, that license would be one price. However, if we license out just the course only, it can be done as what we call per enrollment, where it's just pay one set price for each enrollment of each student. Or one following way we work with other states and districts is by doing what we call a per seat license, where for one set fee, that student occupies a seat and can take as many of our courses as they need or want using the district or the state's teacher.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
Yeah, and since that's certainly a value added to students, but it's also money coming into your school district, how does the state view that when you have that income?
Hi, this is Holly Sagas, and I can address that question through the chair.
Go ahead, Holly.
Okay, sorry, thank you. I wasn't sure if I was still on mute or not. So we have some special language in our statute that actually encourages us to seek those types of revenue streams, and it's very specific in our statute that any dollars that we do receive from licensing our courses must go back into development of new courses in order to benefit, you know, all of our students in Florida, which then, you know, because those dollars are going directly back into course development, not only does it help our students in Florida, it helps all of our partners out of the state as well.
Okay, Senator Kaka?
One last question on that, and it's interesting to me. Is it your school board reports to the state on that income, and with that income, does the state do any matching, or do they take some of it for their regular schooling?
Through the chair, I'm happy to answer that question. This is Holly. So, no, there are no matching funds from the state. However, it does allow us to supplement the, you know, our level of funding that we currently do receive. And, yes, we have to go through all of a regular financial audit every year, just like every school district does, and all of that is reported back up to the state.
That sounds like a pretty good incentive for you, so thank you.
Senator Beckage, did you have a question?
Either to Holly or Virginia. My question is, has the creation of the Florida Virtual School led to reductions in teachers or admin costs for the districts, or is this more of an alternative route for students, just another alternative sort of on the menu of opportunity that students can take advantage of?
Hi, this is Holly, and through the chair, I'd be happy to answer that question. Florida is actually, as a whole, beginning to see a teacher shortage. So, no, we have not seen a decrease in, you know, teachers at the district level because Florida is still growing. Because, you know, students can take virtual courses either through Florida Virtual School or through their district programs, there are a lot of options for students to pick up those courses, and many students will, you know, take a full load at their traditional school and then pick up an additional course through virtual education for a variety of reasons. It could be that they failed a course and they need to retake it. It could be that they live in a very rural area and they want to take an additional course in AP. Or it could be that they live in you know, a rural area and that rural area just cannot find a teacher, you know, for a specific subject area. And so it actually saves the district money in the case where either they can't find a teacher or they just have a few number of students that want to take a course and the district doesn't have to fund the teacher, you know, for a small course load. So we have not seen instances where school districts have, you know, had to decrease their teaching force because of virtual education.
Senator Begich?
Just a brief follow-up. So, but to clarify, it really offers an opportunity in a rural area to access more coursework, and that seems to be the fundamental mission. Is that correct?
Through the chair, this is Holly. I'm happy to answer that. Yes, we actually have in our statute three priority populations that we are to make sure that we have capacity to serve. And one is students in rural districts, so they can have a level playing field and access to the same courses that might be available in a more populated area. The other is for focusing on low-performing schools and making sure that those students have opportunities to take virtual courses. And then the third area is to provide opportunities for our homeschooled students.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is fascinating and really interesting to hear what you're doing, what you've accomplished. The I'm a little interested in knowing how it works on funding of the public schools. Let's say in 2015, public school would receive about $7,000 per student. Does that then, is that modified if that student is taking, say, half-time virtual schools? Or how does that funding actually work?
Hi, this is Holly, and through the chair, I'm happy to answer that question. Before 2013, it did not impact the local school district at all. So if the student was taking 6 courses in their local school district, which is considered a full load in Florida, and then they were taking 1 course with Florida Virtual School, the school district would receive full funding for that student taking the 6 courses, and Florida Virtual School would receive full funding for the student taking the 1 course. Back in 2003, there was, or 2013, there was a modification to the funding formula so that now the student cannot generate more than 1 FTE. So if we take a look at that same student, if the student is now taking 7 courses total, 6 in their traditional school and 1 virtually, the school district, instead of receiving 6-6 or full funding for all 6 courses, now will receive 6/7 of a full FTE, and Florida Virtual School, instead of receiving 1/6 like we were receiving prior to 2013, now will receive 1/7 for that student. So it makes it difficult on a district level to actually determine what your budget is, because you might have students that are funded at, you know, 1/6 for a course. For example, if they're taking 5 in their local school and 1 with Florida Virtual School, everyone gets full funding at the course level for that student. You might have a student where they're earning 1/7 for each course if they're taking 7 courses, or you might have a student that's earning 1/8 of an FTE if they're taking 8 courses total. There is no limit on the number of courses that students can take, but there is a limit on the total funding per student, and so it is just split up proportionately based on the numbers of courses that student is taking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kiesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had previously asked the question, how many Title I students do you serve? And you answered 7,000 full-time students, and about 40% of those were Title I, which is about 2,800 kids. I'm looking at the slide, which says Florida Virtual Schools getting results, and they are bar graphs reflecting flex, full-time, those both being virtual school, and then the state brick-and-mortar approach. I'm wondering if you have a similar format that calls out the outcomes for your Title I students.
Hi, this is Holly. I'm happy to address that question through the chair. I do not have that available with me, but we can get that information to you.
Yes, thank you very much. That would be helpful. I have a few questions. I believe you said you have 7,000 full-time students, correct, and 200,000 students that do access and do take some part-time courses. Are those numbers correct?
Hi, this is Holly. Yes, that's approximately correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. So of those 200,000, how many of those are coming from out of state?
Hi, this is Holly. I'm happy to answer that through the chair. That does not include any out-of-state students. Virginia can address how many students from out-of-state that we serve through our instructional model.
Virginia, are you there? State your name for the record, please.
Through the chair, yes, this is Virginia. I don't have the exact number of
students we serve. I could certainly have someone research how many enrollments go through what we call our business development or global school to determine exactly how many that is, because mainly it is managed by those states and districts and charter schools. But I can certainly get that number for you.
Okay, thank you very much, Virginia. And I guess this is a really basic question, and maybe I missed it, and it should have maybe been early, but is this just 9th grade through 12th grade, or are you serving any middle schoolers or junior high? Holly, would that be a question for you? Holly, can you hear us? Is your phone muted, maybe?
Yes. I'm here. Thank you. I'm not sure I caught the whole question, but through the chair, I will attempt to answer what I think I heard. We serve students in K through 12. The majority of our students are in high school, however.
And do you have that breakout, just, even if it's just rough? How many are high school? Is it 75% high school? Or?
Let me see if I have it here. Let's see. I think it is about 70% in high school, but I don't have it. Oh, here we go. No, that's not what I was looking for. We can get that for you.
Okay, thank you. Are any of your full-time students of those 7,000, are any of those in the lower grades, or are those all high school students?
No, that is K through 12.
Oh, that's very, and the breakout of how many of those of 7,000 are in the lower grades, and how the academic results compare with the other districts, the brick and mortar districts in Florida. Do you have that information? That you, if you don't have it now, could you provide it to us?
Hi, this is Holly. Yes, through the chair, we can provide that information.
All right. Another thing I'd like to help us all envision, if you could describe to us how the facility is set up. What, you have teachers all coming into one location with studios. Do you have some classrooms where some students do come to your location? Do you have multiple locations? Are a lot of these students, are spaces in school buildings throughout the state that are set aside for this, or are students doing it from their homes? Just help us understand where the teachers teach and where the students sit.
Virginia, would you like to take that one?
Through the chair, yes. Inside the state of Florida, our teachers actually work out of home offices. I myself, that's where I came from. I was originally a teacher with us. The students can vary. They may be in a lab inside their brick and mortar school. They may be in their home. And it really depends. We don't limit them as to when they can log on. Their courses are available to the students 24 hours a day. So I'm just speaking myself as a parent. My own kids are in a brick and mortar school, and they come home and do their virtual work here at the house. So they do not report to a center to do that, but we do have some students that do come into those centers to work as well.
Thank you, Virginia. How many do you provide both synchronous and asynchronous classes, or are you primarily doing asynchronous? You said the coursework's available 24/7. Do you have any live two-way video teleconferencing courses?
Through the chair, great question. Yes, we do. That is a component of what is expected of our students. Our teachers provide live lessons, as well as one-on-one, what we call discussion-based assessments, where it's a one-on-one phone call with the student where you're asking them questions about the content they just completed, and it is for a grade. And not only is this a great time for the teacher to, really get an idea of how the student is doing and understanding the
content, but it also, as a teacher, gave me the great opportunity, if they did not quite get something, it gave me that opportunity to reteach during that phone call and that one-on-one time, as well as build a relationship with my student, because it is a very different dynamic than being face-to-face in your brick-and-mortar classroom. So we do have that piece of it as well. It also helps us aid in academic integrity to make sure the student that is working online is the same student that we're talking to on the phone.
Thank you. Do you have a ratio of students per teacher? Do you limit classes to not go above a certain number? And then how does that compare with the brick-and-mortar ratio of students per teacher?
Hi, this is Holly. I'm happy to answer that question through the chair. So we don't have a hard cap on the number of students that can be served by a teacher. However, we do generally say that we try to limit our teachers to about 150 students as a full load, which is very comparable to what you might find in a traditional classroom. However, some courses, like an AP course, may have fewer students, and some elective courses may have a few more students. But on average, we try to, you know, keep our teachers at around that 150 mark.
Okay. I have one more question, and I'm just wondering, the teachers that you have, I believe you said you had 1,200 teachers, if I remember correctly, and maybe adjunct, but maybe it was 2,000. I'm being signaled. Are you seeing that it takes a different type of teacher to do this kind of work? And I'm thinking when, especially for the synchronous, where you have the two-way, that you would need to have a teacher that's quite engaging when it's through a screen as opposed to maybe in a room. I'm just wondering, have you found that this is not necessarily a good fit for all teachers? Do you find that the quality of teachers that are drawn to this is different than what might be in the brick-and-mortar classroom? Or
Virginia, do you want to take that one? If not, I'm happy to take it.
I'd be happy to take it through the chair. I would say, and this is just my personal opinion, most of us who came from the brick-and-mortar or the traditional school setting, it does take, in my opinion, a certain mindset to do virtual teaching. You do have to really engage your students in a different way and use different modes, like through text and phone and email, and there's different ways you really need to draw them in. I believe, and Holly, if you disagree, let me know. I believe, you know, we've been lucky at Florida Virtual School that experienced teachers come to us, so we have had the benefit of choosing the best of the best, and we do have certain characteristics we look for as far as being able to engage those students, because it is a different talent or skill.
Thank you. And as a follow-up, and I'll try to, that this will be the last one, because pertaining to teachers, and then Senator Stevens has a question, and then we will have to wrap up because we want to give New York fair time, and we're about at the halfway point. And that is, Virginia, do you provide training for the teachers specific to this style and method of delivery?
Through the chair. Yes, great question. Inside the state of Florida, for our direct teachers, yes, there is training involved, and it is very specific to teaching online and using best practices that over, you know, we have been in business now almost 20 years, things that we have found work and work well with students. So, yes, there is specific training involved in how to reach students in a virtual environment. Outside of the state, when I work with different districts or charter schools or so on, yes, there is some training involved as a professional development. That almost they can choose from a menu of trainings that they prefer based on their teacher population and what they're really looking to do, anywhere from best practices to how to teach in an online environment, communication skills, how to conduct those live lessons, you know, some best practices there as well. So, yes, there is a specific training that really should go into enacting something like this.
Okay, thank you very much. And Senator Stevens has a final question. And go ahead, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Each state is so different. Our state, we pretty much let the districts solve their own problem in distance education, and consequently we have some that are very successful and some that are not. And your system is quite admirable, I think, in many ways. But I guess my question is, do the districts pretty much leave to you the issue of distance education, or are they still doing their own distance education programs?
Hi, this is Holly, and through the chair, I'm happy to answer that question. It's a combination. It's a real partnership. Through our franchise program, districts can have their own program, you know, empowered by Florida Virtual School, meaning that it's our courses, our back-end systems, and the training that we provide to the district teachers. And those programs in whole throughout the state, if you look at all of the various franchises, and almost every district participates in some sort of a franchise, together, I think that they serve around about half the number of students that we serve. So in some cases, it makes more sense either financially and or academically to have a local teacher providing that distance learning opportunity for students. And in other cases, it makes more sense for that student to come to Florida Virtual School at the state level. And the students have the choice, too. So, you know, a student can choose to take the course through their local district, or they can choose to take it at the state level.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'm going to just ask one really quick question, because it's a real quick one. Do any of your teachers live outside of Florida? You said they use home offices, so got me thinking.
Hi, this is Holly. I'll go ahead and answer that very quickly through the chair. 95% plus of our teachers live in Florida. We try to recruit our teachers for our in-state program to be Florida teachers. However, one of the beauties of, you know, virtual learning and distance education is that if there is a problem, for example, suppose we can't find a Chinese teacher in the state of Florida, you do have that opportunity to recruit teachers that may live somewhere else.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been pretty fascinating. If you can afford the time and you can stay on and listen, if we have any time after we hear from New York, we might have more questions for you. But at this point, thank you very much. And we will move on now to the New York State Distance Learning Consortium. And Mike Beba, are you online? We're going to take a quickie at ease to get the technology up to speed here. We're back on the record. Mike, good morning. Well, it's probably afternoon your time. It's morning here. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. And yes, it's 12:45 here. I've already had lunch, and you guys are just getting started.
So, state your name and affiliation for the record, please, and begin.
Well, thank you, Chairman Hughes, for the opportunity to speak with you in the committee this morning. My name is Mike Beba, and I am one of the two co-presidents of the New York State Distance Learning Consortium. I'm going to try and project my PowerPoint to you, so my apologies, because you'll probably have to crane your neck to see it. But there's only a few slides, and I will try to keep it short and sweet, although my conversations with Joshua, as he knows already, I'm very passionate about what I do, so it's hard for me to stop talking.
So we do have paper copies of those slides in front of us as well. So
wonderful. Okay. Well, then, in that case, then we don't need to...
Well, actually, for those in, we do have some in the audience here, Mr. Beba, so if you want to project them, then the rest could see them as well.
All right, so let me share my screen with you. And switch to the PowerPoint. How's that?
Perfect.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Again, thank you for inviting our consortium to share a little bit about who we are and what we do. The New York State Distance Learning Consortium consists of member BOCES. In New York State, there are intermediary service organizations that are assigned groups of school districts to deliver services in hopefully a more cost-effective manner. There are 37 BOCES, or Boards of Cooperative Educational Services, that serve the 700-plus school districts here in New York. And many of those BOCES offer some sort of distance education, either two-way interactive video or online, or in most cases a combination of both. Our consortium consists of 29 members. Joining is as simple as if your BOCES has a distance education service that you sell to your component school districts, you're eligible to join. Then the choice is, do you want to pay the membership dues? Our membership dues are $300 per BOCES per year. It's not a lot of money. Just helps us fund our meetings and those kinds of things. The purposes of our consortium include joint planning, the sharing of expertise with one another. We do hope to influence policy when it comes to distance education here in the state. We also provide support for new members. That's actually one of the largest, I think, services that we offer to our membership, is when new people come into the job, most of us don't have large groups or large teams to deliver services to our schools, and so we become sort of a training ground and group therapy location for people who don't have anyone else who understands what we do for a living. And, of course, the sharing of courses. As an overview, the whole purpose of our consortium is to pursue academic opportunities for students through the use of technology. And that can be in many different ways. We started, it was interesting, I came on at the very end of the Florida Virtual, and when they said they've been in place now for about 20 years. We've been doing interactive video in New York for about that, maybe a year or two longer than that. It started out for us as interactive video only, and we've evolved into both online and blended learning. And it's been just amazing to see the growth and the change of technology and what it can do for students. Every BOCES is very unique in that we are a school, so districts, our component districts, send us students for special education, career and technical education. We have some alternative education opportunities for districts that can't provide alternative schooling for their students, but we're also service providers. So my schools, our local school districts, purchase my distance learning service, and as a result, we deliver and assist them in the locating of courses and other opportunities using technology to enhance learning. New York encourages BOCES participation. The BOCES were started, by, they were enacted by legislation back in the late 1940s, actually, as a way to, for districts to provide career and technical education when it made sense to pool resources. It's evolved since then into all of those other services that I mentioned, technology. We offer labor relations services for some of our smaller districts, that kind of thing. And the state offers an incentive through a complex aid formula. So when districts use BOCES for services, they are granted state aid back to encourage that sharing of resources. The formula is incredibly complex. I've never met a person who can explain it to me in English, but I'm sure there's someone who is at our state education department who knows how to figure that out. It's basically based on district wealth. So there are complex calculations for district wealth based on property values and individual incomes of people within the school district. When I do my New York State income taxes, I put my school district on my taxes because that's a part of that wealth calculation that impacts our school district's aid rate for reimbursement for BOCES and other sharing besides using our BOCES services. So our consortium, each one of our individual BOCES members offers distance learning classes. They could be fully video synchronous daily classes. They could be completely online classes. Or we're coming to the belief that especially for students in the K-12 arena, that a blended model is really probably the best way to deliver content for those students. They're not quite ready for the whole completely virtual experience. It can be very difficult for kids to stay with it without the periodic face-to-face time with a teacher. But the students themselves do not get to select the classes that are offered here in New York. The local district that is a part of my BOCES service and or a part of our consortium has access to a database from which they can select courses that they would like to offer to their students. So the districts themselves are the ones that select the courses that they will offer to their students. And then if we can work out all of the logistics come September, or if it's a one-semester course come January when our second semester begins, then those courses are available to students. That doesn't prevent our schools, if they'd like to use online curriculum from Florida Virtual or from Apex or Odysseyware or any of the vendors that are out there, those districts can choose to do that on their own. All the consortium, you know, all of the consortium membership does is, which I shouldn't say all it does, but one of the things it does is give them access so that they can share courses from other BOCES member school districts. All of our courses are taught either by BOCES instructors or New York State certified teachers in the school from which the courses emanate. And that's been by state statute. New York State teacher certification is required for all the K-12 instruction. Excuse me. The course costs vary by BOCES. In some ways, when I began talking a little bit with Joshua, one of the things that I sort of began to grasp is the vastness of your state and the locations of your districts, and yet New York is in some ways similar in that we are very large and we have five large cities that are scattered across the state, but the rest of our state, you know, you've got the whole Adirondack region and the whole southern tier of New York that have some very, very small school districts in it as well, and the cost of living in various parts of our state vary. So the course costs have to be locally controlled. So each BOCES region works with their participating school districts to determine what the costs are. But if one of my districts chooses to buy a course from another consortium member school, we pay the rate that that consortium charges their own school districts for the course that we want to participate in. The current range of courses right of course costs right now is from free. There are some BOCES who don't charge at all for their courses, and there are some that have full-time teachers, and so they take the cost of that teacher and divide it up by the number of participating school districts. And the most expensive one I'm aware of right now is $10,200 per course. That's not per student. That's a per-course cost. The video courses are charged by the course usually, where online courses are usually charged by the student. And, again, even our online courses must have a New York State certified teacher of record. So it's either a school district employee or one of the member BOCES who has a staff member who's assigned as the instructor for the class. Again, the courses are selected by the school district, and part of that, I believe, is done to ensure that the course offerings will not conflict with the local school district program. And what I mean by that is if districts have had to, if districts, because of funding, have had to reduce their, let's say, their business department, and then all of a sudden they begin to start offering 4 and 5 and 6 different business classes, our teacher unions are not very fond of that, and they don't want, and our districts don't want to be perceived as using this kind of technology to eliminate staff members just to save money. So a lot of that, so our consortium practice is that distance education will not be used to supplant existing staff positions. What we're trying to do is enhance opportunities for students, fill gaps and needs that can't be met because teachers aren't available. Right now in New York, it's almost impossible to find a certified physics teacher. And another difficult certification is American Sign Language here in New York State. So lots of our schools will use our distance learning offerings and video classes to offer those kinds of services that they can't find the instructors for. We really have two big barriers that do make the coordination of our courses a challenge. The first one is there is no common instructional calendar in New York State. Every local school district is allowed to set their own calendar. They must meet. They start. New York State offers a start date and an end date. The end date especially is set by the Regents examination schedule. Here in New York, we have statewide examinations. So you have to be finished with or start your Regents exams. Usually it's by the second week of June. But in terms of when districts want to plot out their 180 days of student attendance, that is a local decision, and so we have many districts who do not follow a common calendar. The other thing that's a bit of a hurdle for us is there is no common bell schedule. As I said earlier, we're also a school at BOCES, and some of our districts are very close to us, and some of them are far away, and if they have to send their students to BOCES, their school day starts earlier so that their students can get to school, then get transported to BOCES for their career in tech programming or their alternative ed programming. And so common bell schedules don't happen here in New York State either. If ever we could get to either one, or if we had both of those, our distance education program, especially the synchronous video, would expand even further than it does, and it's quite large now. The last thing I would like to academic results. I skipped a page in my handouts. We've not done a formal study to compare student performance between face-to-face instructors and students who are on video remotely. All we have are anecdotal reports from our teachers, and it's to me somewhat ironic. It's not anymore. I've been doing this job now for 18 years, but that's the one thing that we never hear, that they feel like students are not performing academically as well in the remote locations. There are other challenges to video-based teaching and learning. The fact that when I was a teacher, I was a high school social studies teacher, and when I had a student who was starting to act up, I could physically just walk over. I didn't even have to stop teaching. I could just walk over and stand near them, and my proximity let them know that I knew that they were misbehaving, and often it would just stop. And we don't have those kinds of advantages in the video world. But in terms of the teacher's perception of pupil performance academically, that has never even been raised by any of our instructors as an issue. We were awarded a New York State Virtual Advanced Placement Grant back in, I believe, 2012-13. It was a three-year grant, and we ran 15 different AP classes, and our AP classes exceeded both the national and state averages for AP test results, and we exceeded them dramatically. The New York State average was, I believe, like 26% passing with a 4 or a 5 on the AP exam, and our numbers were in the 60% range. And those were mostly blended courses where the students were both seen by their teachers on video and also had access to their course content online. The teacher return rate, at least in our BOCES, is well in excess of 95%. All of our teachers do this voluntarily. They are all local school district employees, and they choose to do this. And it's well over 95%. It's probably closer to 98 or 99% that teachers, once they teach either in the online or in the video environment, they just come back because they enjoy it a lot. Our course catalog, which I do want to take a minute and show you, is expanding every year. And the other wonderful program that we've got locally, and many of the BOCES and many of our consortium members have, is a program through our local community colleges where our high school faculty who meet the requirements are given adjunct college professor status, so that their courses that they teach during their high school day are also awarded dual college credit. In our region, we have a wonderful relationship with our community college, and our community college grants the tuition free. So we've had, I would guess over the last 15 to 20 years, we've probably saved parents and students, I would say a safe number is $1 million in college credit. It's been a wonderful addition to our distance learning program in my region, and many of the BOCES, many of our consortium members have those same kind of relationships. Not all of them have free tuition. Many of them have a reduced tuition rate. We are fortunate that ours has been free. Where I see us going in the near future, our video-based synchronous classes are not going away anytime soon. Brick-and-mortar schools in New York are not going to disappear anytime soon. However, as budgets get tighter and tighter, and as the state puts more and more mandates on our local districts to provide especially academic intervention services and catch-up services to try to keep graduation rates on track, video-based distance learning classes have become a real boon for providing especially lots and lots of elective opportunities for students, as the teacher demands in the local districts are being taken by other tasks that have to be that have been mandated by the Education Department. We offer also, and will continue to do so, online, fully online-based teacher-created and vendor-supplied classes. So we have some of our schools that want to use the content that is provided by like a Florida Virtual or an Apex or Odyssey, where are some of the bigger names in that world. And so we provide support and training for those teachers in that in those products. Additionally, we also provide teachers with a blank slate. We use a product called Moodle, and it's a learning management system so that teachers can, if they want to, learn to build a class from the ground up, and it's their own custom-created content. We support that, and all many of our consortium members do the same thing. As I said before, blended classes, I see blending as being the wave of the near future for us. As districts begin to look at ways to offer more and more classes for children, I think about things like being able to offer classes opposite biology lab. Our labs usually only meet twice a week. So if I could have biology lab meeting on Mondays and Wednesdays, I could have a different online or blended class meet on Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. So I see that exploding in the next 3 to 5 years. We are looking at the best practices for all of the models of instruction so that we can teach our teachers how, you know, one of the questions I heard at the very end when I joined the teleconference was the training that Florida Virtual offered. And our consortium members all offer those same kinds of training to make sure that our teachers are doing their best to reach students both in a face-to-face video instruction as well as in an online or blended fashion. New technologies, the way I'm connected to you today, is a newer product. We've been very appliance-based in the past, and with the advent of web video conferencing, we're looking at some new technologies that should make it easier for students and teachers to be able to participate and get the kind of teaching and learning that they'd like to receive. So I did put a link to our shared statewide consortium catalog. If you'll notice, the tagline is E2CCB. That's the organization that I work for. My BOCES is called Erie 2 Chautauqua Cattaraugus. Those are all the counties that our school districts reside in that are in our service area. And we house this database, but the database is shared by, I believe at last count, we have 20 different BOCES who are all using that same database to market their classes. So we load that data, I need to stop the share, and then I can jump out quick. And I'm going to get off my email. And that. Sorry about that. Oh! If you guys are interested in taking a peek, I created a user ID and password for you that would let you into the database. All right, so we want to go back and resume sharing. Are you guys seeing the database now?
We are, yes.
Okay, so this catalog, I'm going to just click the view all, so you can search by each BOCES. This is the list of all of the, each one of these BOCES are a member of our statewide consortium, and so all of them have chosen to populate this database with courses that are available to their own schools as well as to be shared with the rest of the state. So I'm just going to click on the View All button just because that's the fastest way to just show you the list. So there are 815 entries. Not all of them are active. You can see that the status is either active or inactive. I can come up here and click on only active, and that'll filter out So for the 2016-2017 school year, our consortium had 334 possible courses that were available to be shared by districts either in their own local BOCES region or by other consortium member school districts. The user ID and password that was on the handout that I gave you will let you in, and you can do that. You can poke around in here all you want, but that user ID and password won't allow you to make any changes, but it will allow you to search and just look and see what's out there and what's available. If you click on a course title, and I'm trying to find one of mine, so I'm hoping it'll have the details, you see the details of the class, whether it carries college credit or not, who the teacher is, what department, and the schools that are participating. And at the bottom, there's room for a course description so that, and we use this as a tool to market to our schools so that they can start to look for classes that they might find interesting for their student population.
Mr. Beba, is there a place where you can click to see a sample of the teacher giving, you know, from a previous clip, them teaching? Is that?
Not in this database, but I can have, address you correctly through the chair, my apologies, that we do have, we have a whole separate video library. Many of our courses are recorded, some of them daily, some of them on an as-needed basis, based on the instructor preference. I'm going to stop sharing for right now because that's the extent of my presentation, and that way I can see you guys and you can see me. So I can send some links. I can forward links to you to, so that you can see some of the recordings that we've done. I just want to make sure I get permission from the teachers before I share their recordings.
Yes, thank you very much. I was thinking more from the marketing aspect, somebody who's looking if there's a number of accounting classes, for instance, you might want to look to see the teacher's style and pick it that way. So Senator Begich has a question.
I do. Thank you for the presentation, Mike. I've done a little bit of work on juvenile justice issues in the state, and specifically I've spent about 4 years working with Nassau County. And in Nassau County, of course, there are over 50 school districts in the county alone. So my sort of two-part question is, first, typically about how large is a BOCES? How many school districts does it have in it? And then secondarily, when you describe these, they sound essentially like they don't necessarily need to be government run. They could, in fact, be like a nonprofit association could do a BOCES that would just create this shared consortium of classes and opportunities. So the first one is typically how many school districts, and second is could the model work outside of, if you will, the government structure to work directly with the districts to form, maybe through one of our nonprofit associations, this idea of a consortium?
Sure. And through the chair, the BOCES are literally, we are educational entities that were created by statute. So we are a school district as well as a service provider. We are treated like a school district by New York State, so there are no private BOCES that I am aware of. However, that said, there have been institutions, the one that I'm thinking of is no longer active, but for example, none of the big five schools, the five large city schools in New York State, do not belong to any BOCES. That doesn't preclude them from buying services. They are allowed to buy services from us, but they don't receive the same treatment in terms of that aid formula and reimbursement because they're funding, the big five schools are funded differently than the rest of the state. So it could be done. One of the historical conundrums, I guess is a good word, that New York State has faced is sometimes because BOCES have become almost like our own mini bureaucracies, we sometimes have lost sight of the cost effectiveness reactive nature of what we're supposed to be doing. So our overhead sometimes gets large because our BOCES are large. My particular BOCES, we have, I believe, our total enrollment, student enrollment, is 30,000. We have 27 school districts in our region. And our geography is approximately, if you drove from the two furthest schools in our geography, it's a two-hour drive by car. So geographically, we're large. Student enrollment-wise, we're probably in the middle or even on the lower end. So the BOCES are very, very unique and customized. Down in Nassau County, which is just outside of New York City on Long Island, there are that BOCES probably is one-tenth the geographic size of we are, yet their student population is probably double our student population because of how densely populated some parts of the state are versus, you know, where I am. My largest school district has 10,000 students K through 12. Our smallest school district has under 500 students K through 12. So we have big fish and very, very small fish in our large geographic pond.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you. My questions are related to the demographics and outcomes for Title I students. So, do you have any breakout data of how many Title I students you are serving and how their performance compares to others?
Through the chair, and that was Senator Geisel?
Correct.
We do not have that data, and that's because the way when two school districts decide to share a class through our consortium or through our BOCES, those students do not become BOCES students. The students remain students of their own school district, and through a very complex, as we seem to be able to make everything complex in New York, but through a very complex reporting system, the students that have the teacher face-to-face with them are reported from their school, as well as the students in the receiving site. If I'm on the receiving end of our class, my school has to send my student information to your school so that I can be reported as a student with your teacher. BOCES has no role in that whatsoever. So that data is literally collected and monitored just on a district-by-district basis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Coghill.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. This is really great. We're trying to figure out how to best use our distance education in Alaska. It sounds to me like the BOCES has another interesting counting issue that we heard about in Florida, probably very different than you. But how do you true up an annual student count?
Through the chair, that's a very complicated question. So one of the things that we do, if you do get a chance to look at the database, there is a place for us. The way that database works, by the way, is that each BOCES has editing rights to their own content. So in the courses that come from the BOCES that I belong to, I keep track of who the teaching sites are and who the receiving sites are, and then it's my job to pursue the school districts to get the enrollment numbers for each one of those classes. I use that database to track that information. If you look at the details, you'd see there's an enrollment, a place to keep enrollment, but not every BOCES does that. Every BOCES does that in their own way and in their own fashion. It's so strange to me that we have 37 BOCES and they are 37 completely independent and totally different entities, even though we're all enacted by the same statute. Welcome to New York.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Beba. It's been very interesting. You mentioned that per course, depending what the BOCES decides, the cost is anywhere from 0 free to 10,000, a little over 10,000, I believe. Do you know how that compares to a brick and mortar course? Has that ever been, the math been done so you see where what you're offering compares to traditional courses in New York?
There has been, to my knowledge, and it may be have been, it may be being done at the state level, but that has never been shared with me. I can tell you that as I think about how much I know, like, again, because we're a school, I know how much our teachers cost. So if I take one of an average teacher cost in New York, at least here in Western New York, because our cost of living is much less than downstate near New York City is, I would say an average teacher cost here in Western New York is hovering at around between $75,000 and $80,000. It would be average. Newer teachers slightly less, more experienced teachers significantly more, but I would say $80,000 is a safe number. So if that teacher is responsible for teaching five classes, can't do the math. One-fifth of that, so if that teacher is assigned to distance, let's use 90 because that math I can do. So that's $15,000 if they are teaching six classes, and that's a local contract decision, how many classes each teacher teaches through the course of the day. But if the average teacher cost for one period is $15,000, and I have a district that's actually taking Mandarin Chinese, and they're paying that $10,000. So they're paying $10,000 for that one period. Their own teacher is probably costing them $15,000. So if they have six or seven students enrolled in that Mandarin class, it's less expensive than it is if they have seven students enrolled in a comparable local class.
Okay, thank you. Another question, you mentioned that the retention was very high. 95% was what you had in the slide, and I think you said it, you thought it was more like 98. Do you know what the retention is in the brick-and-mortar schools in New York?
Through the chair, sorry. our teacher retention rate in New York is probably comparable to that. Our pension system is delightful here in New York State. We're blessed that way. I would see, again, though, it will vary by location because we are so diverse. You know, we've got some very difficult urban settings that make it very challenging to retain teachers, and yet then we've got suburban and rural districts that are wonderful. I'm looking outside. If I look outside my window right now, I look across, and there's a vineyard across the driveway and a cornfield across the street from me. I've been here 18 years, and I'm not going anywhere until they force me to retire.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Beba? Well, we thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. I want to acknowledge also the Commissioner of Education has been here in the room listening to this, Commissioner Michael Johnson, so I'm sure he's taking it in. We'll have conversations. So thank you very much for being with us today. And with that, I want to announce what we're doing next week. So we're going to take a little break on Monday. So our next meeting will be at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, February 22nd. And that will be a joint meeting with the House Education regarding teacher recruitment and retention in Alaska. So thank you very much, everyone. And with that, we will gavel out at 9:24.